Take careful note of what time it is, please. 22 minutes after already. So you won't feel when it's straight up 4 o'clock, oh no, he's going overtime again. I have a few things to say to you today that might take real close to 1 hour. Interesting that Joe chose that song because it certainly does fit right in with what I have for you today, that this is our Father's world. I don't mean the society. I mean the earth on which we dwell. If you want a title for this, it is God is Creator, or maybe even God and You. Who is God? Where is He? And who are you, and where are you going? I guess the most profound book in the Bible, and one that people ignore most of the time and just read a few moments in it and then decide they've gotten very bored, is the one entitled Chop, or Chops, or Job, however you want to pronounce it. I believe that there is adequate historical evidence to demonstrate that the way it used to be pronounced, because many languages, Eastern European in particular, do use the word J, or the letter J, rather, with a CH pronunciation, like Chop, and B can be pronounced like a P in some tongues. The Great Pyramid of Chops, or Chop, is very likely, according to internal evidence in the Bible, and even some of the statements God uses in bringing Job or Chop down to size, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? There is strong historical evidence to indicate that the builder of the Great Pyramid was actually Job, that he was the designer, that he was the engineer, he was the builder of that structure. Whether he was or not, the book of Job is one of the most profound because it gets right into the heart of one of the biggest problems of most professing Christians today. Right into the heart and the core of some of the biggest personal problems of some of the greatest Christian men that I have ever known. I could stand here and name them by name and you would know exactly what I'm talking about. And that is the problem of the relationship of an individual to his God. Now, what is your private relationship with God? When we were up in Huntsville, Alabama, at the campaign, we had a gospel quartet come and sing for us at the services. And apparently they're quite well known in that neck of the woods and sing at churches and so on. And they sang a song that went something like, "Me and Jesus got it all worked out." And it was a real rock kind of a beat, four-part harmony with a banjo and a guitar, and everybody's feet were kind of tapping away. And it had the chorus that said over and over again, "Me and Jesus got it all worked out. The Lord and I got a good thing going." And it talked about all these problems, but don't worry because me and Jesus got it worked out. We got a good thing going. Everybody has this special, personal relationship with God, or so they think. That's what Job thought, apparently. There's a very fine line of difference between righteousness and self-righteousness, and Job didn't recognize that fine line of distinction. Now, last Sabbath, Mr. Dark preached a very, very fine sermon, one that I would really urge you, if you didn't get to hear it, or even if you did hear it, to hear it again by getting the tape cassette on that particular sermon that showed where salvation is available. And to make it very short, it's available in your closet among all the old discarded clothing and shoes and things that you've been wanting to clean out but maybe haven't. It's available to you just as much as muscles are available to a young man who would like to go to the gym and lift weights. And it does help you understand the expression, "work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." He explained very thoroughly, as I would not want to take 10 minutes to interrupt myself to do, that you cannot earn salvation. He made that very clear. But he also made very clear there are things you must do, and that we ought to get busy and simply do them. Told you exactly what they are, approximately what is the frequency, how to do it, how to get started on a program that is going to eventually lead you toward salvation. A very profound part of it was touching upon the comparisons that begin to arise between you and another individual who is doing exactly what he said we ought to do. which is pray and study and fast, and that sounds very ministerial. We used to have crises on the average of about twice a week in the college, and some hyper-spiritual type would get up and tell everybody, now you're not fasting enough, and you're not praying enough, and you're not studying enough. I don't care how spiritual you are. You're on very safe ground anytime you as a human being get up and pontificate to other human beings that those human beings aren't as righteous as they ought to be. You're going to get nothing but yes answers from people who are sincere. You're going to make them feel beat down, inferior, like you have found them out, like you know something about their private lives that they hoped you didn't know, and you will have a successful sermon if you're trying to make your audience feel inferior and spiritually derelict, and make them think you are spiritually superior, and you got a good thing going, you got it all worked out with the Lord. Now that's not my purpose at all today, but I have strongly suspected in past times when I have felt like that, listening to someone else preach or teach or lecture, that maybe that's what they were trying to make me feel like. Like they had a good thing going with the Lord, they and Jesus were just like this, where was I? Now Job is a very superbly intelligent human being. In the first book of Job, we've heard this story before about how Satan apparently had access to God's throne. It says in verse 6, there was a day when the sons of God, meaning angels, came to present themselves before the Eternal, and Satan came also among them. And the Eternal said unto Satan, where did you come from? And Satan said, oh, I'm from going back and forth and up and down, you know, wandering around in the world, just kind of kicking at tin cans and rocks and sitting on the courthouse steps and chatting with people, looking around, seeing what the folks are doing down there. The Eternal said unto Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth? Quite a statement coming from God. A perfect and an upright man, one that fears God and avoids, shuns, or hates evil. Satan answered the Eternal and says, does Job fear God for nothing? It's got to be some motive, got to be a reason. Haven't you made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side? Haven't you been interfering in his life, been blessing him, and his substance is increased in the land? But you put forth your hand and touch all that he has, and he'll turn around and curse you to your face. The Eternal said unto Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself do not put forth your hand. So the devil went forth from the presence of the Eternal. There was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and there came a messenger unto Job and said, the oxen were plowing, and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them away. And they've killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell you. Now that's horrible news. Terrible loss. And while he was still telling him all this bad news, there came another and said, the fire of God has fallen from heaven, and has burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell you. Now, it wasn't the fire of God. It was the fire of the devil, because Satan the devil, remember, was the one who was afflicting Job. And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the Chaldeans made out three bands and fell upon the camels and have carried them away and have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped to tell you. And while he's giving him this additional horrible news, now the sheep are gone, the cattle are gone, the camels are gone, another one said, your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and a tornado came along, a great wind, and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they're all dead. And I only am escaped to tell you. Now, how in the world could you deal with that? I mean, it's bad enough to have to deal with some of the heartaches that we suffer. Only a few weeks ago, I had to perform what, to me, was the most sorrowful sermon of my life, standing for over an hour by the open bier of a young man only 16 and a half, whose parents are known to me, and all of his friends and family and his grandparents I've known for more than 25 years, and to see what was only a dead corpse, absolutely cold, immobile, and all shaped and molded back into shape by the embalming fluid in the body that the funeral parlor had placed there, to see the agony and the anguish on these people's faces, to see the entire class file by and look at that boy's dead body, and to see these parents and grandparents trying to cope with that disaster that struck their lives. What about the size of this disaster? All of his sons and daughters, all of his cattle, all of his sheep, all of his property, the house gone, everything gone. Job rose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked will I return thither. The Eternal gave, and the Eternal has taken away." Correct? No? No? Mistake. It wasn't correct. Now, they use that statement in many a sermon that you will hear at a graveside. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Is that really true? Following Adam and Eve's sin, was it the Lord who took away? Or didn't the Lord give over into the hands of man the sole decision-making process? In the day you eat thereof, you shall surely die. And hasn't man basically been, just like Job tended to do, blaming God ever since? Now, it's a very fine line I want you to come to understand today. The young family I talked about didn't blame God for a minute. And yet, back in the back of your mind, you always wonder, why me? And why did God allow it to happen? And you think of all of these dozens of things that come through your mind, of the what ifs, and why now, and you just really can't cope with it. So Job thought that the Eternal had something to do with it, but really Satan the devil was allowed to do everything to Job except to afflict him personally, as far as his physical body was concerned. The Eternal is taken away, blessed be the name of the Eternal. Now that wasn't a sin for him to say that, because it says, verse 22, "In all this Job sinned not, nor charged God." He didn't blame God, but he said, that's the way God is. You never know. He can give, and since he gave, it's his to take away. "Nor charged God foolishly." Now you know the remainder of this, and I won't bore you with going through all of the rest of it, how he was stricken with boils, and then we begin this tiresome dialogue back and forth between Eliphaz and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar. Job answers them, and one by one they answer him. And I mean, it just gets very, very heavy indeed. Let's see just a few examples of it. Going over to chapter 8, Bildad the Shuhite. He's the shortest man in the Bible, you remember. You've heard about him before. Never mind. Chapter 8, verse 2. He said, "How long will you speak these things, and how long shall the words of your mouth be like a strong wind?" Just like a windbag. "Does God pervert judgment, or doth the Almighty pervert justice? If your children have sinned against them, and he has cast them away for their transgression..." Ah, that's kind of the kind of reasoning a lot of people use, isn't it? I dedicated a radio program at the death of young Joe Pyle. And I wanted to make sure that I got across in that radio program that there is, just like the people who came up to Jesus and wondered about the mass death, the mass suicide, or the mass murder, rather, of the men in the shadow of the Tower of Siloam, the men whom had been slaughtered by Pilate, who had been found sacrificing illegally. Jesus had to answer their obvious question, "Do you suppose these men were sinners above all others that dwelt in Jerusalem?" I tell you, no, they weren't. And there were those, I'm sure, who began to suspect, well, now the Pyle family, see? I mean, look what happened here now. Jack and Ray and Den, now they've kind of gone out of the ministry. And maybe God is punishing the Pyle family. Took away young Joe Dan. That'll fix you, Norvell. That'll fix you, Mr. and Mrs. Pyle. God got you. Don't you think for a minute that people do not reason that way? That there is not a supercilious, hypocritical self-righteousness in the back of a lot of would-be Christian people, who are about as Christian as some of the devil's cohorts, who actually attribute that kind of character to God Himself, that in order to nudge you a little bit, God will kill your son. Does He really work that way? Is that the lesson that we're supposed to get out of human suffering? Now, that's what Bildad thought. Now, you know, if you're not careful, and I've been through this exercise before, you can read the entire book of Job. You can hear Job's rationalization, you can hear his arguments, and you can listen to these attacks by Zophar or Bildad or Eliphaz, and you'll say, yeah, That sounds pretty logical, pretty rational. I have seen ministers make the mistake of just going through an exhaustive concordance and picking out a particular text, some statement they want to corroborate some other portion of the Bible, and go back and get into chapter 8 or somewhere else and be quoting from Zophar or from maybe Bildad. They don't know what God said about these guys a little later on. So let's keep that in abeyance and don't judge yet, but let's go back and see a little later on what God said about these three friends' arguments. So notice that even he began to think that the kids must have been doing something evil. What were they doing in that house just before the tornado struck? Job answered in chapter 9 and verse 12, "Behold, he takes away. Who can hinder him? Who will say to God, 'What are you doing?'" Verse 17, "He breaks me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not suffer me to take my breath, but fills me with bitterness." Chapter 10, verse 1, "My soul is weary of life." Verse 15 of that chapter, "If I be wicked, woe unto me, and if I be righteous, yet will I not lift up my head." Very nice attitude, wouldn't you think? "I am full of confusion. Therefore, look upon my affliction, for it increases. You hunt me as a fierce lion." Talking about God. Many hours, apparently, of arguments all the way through this book of Job. Chapter, let me see, a little later on here. I want to turn back to the 27th chapter. "Moreover, Job continued his parable and said, 'As God lives, who has taken away my judgment, and the Almighty, who has vexed my soul.'" Now, at this time, you know, he was sitting there not only with his family dead, with his cattle, his sheep, and everything gone, with his home and all of his properties destroyed, but he was sitting there in the most excruciating agony with great carbuncles and boils on his body, so that there was no place he could lie down and get away from the pain. And they were oozing pus, and he was reaching out to get a shard of a broken pot and scraping this weeping stuff that was oozing out of these terrible sores. That is the most agonizing condition you can imagine a person being in. Verse 3, "All the while my breath is in me." In other words, as long as I live and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, "my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. God forbid that I should justify you. Till I die, I will not remove mine integrity from me. I know a man that I will not speak of by name, of whom I believe that he is perhaps one of the most evil men I've ever known. A man who lies seemingly just to keep in practice. A man who has no such thing as the word character, and a man who is so absolutely, unbelievably tenacious over the word integrity. A man without integrity, and a man who will seemingly kill anyone who says anything to deny that he has integrity." That is a healthy dose of self-deception and of self-righteousness such as I've never seen before. Job said, "Till I die, I will not remove mine integrity from me." Now, what was Job's most important possession? What was his most prized possession? It had to be what we just read. Verse 6, "My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. I know a man who, in one very lengthy, hard-nosed college lecture, drove a young boy to his death. A man who was able, by certain body English, by certain use of the hypnotic stare, a man by the use of his voice and by use of the knowledge of the Bible that he had, was able to deal with the innermost secrets of human hearts, with people who had bad habits, people who had certain voyeuristic compulsions, people who had certain sex problems, certain problems of the appetite, certain mental problems. He was able in an hour's lecture in a classroom to so beat those people down, they were even shorter than Bildad, the shoe height. They couldn't even look over the laces of their shoes. They felt like they belonged under the shoe. Well, unbeknownst to the professor that I'm speaking of now, there was a young boy in his class that had some very serious mental hang-ups. and like millions of human beings, and like, to one degree or another, all of us, had some deep-seated feelings of guilt. We all have feelings of guilt. We all allow ourselves things that we shouldn't. We do things that we shouldn't. We come up short. We stumble. We make mistakes. And if you have a particularly powerful or insistent, plodding preacher type who tells you your sin will find you out, and then just beats that theme into your head for an hour, he can make your conscience very, very sore, very bruised, very, very sensitized. Well, he was talking about leading a double life, and talking about being a hypocrite, and talking of what it says in the Bible about Judgment Day, and how Christ is going to call every little thing into account, and the things that are spoken in whispers will be shouted from the housetops, and everything that you've done in secret will be known to everyone. By the time he was through with that hour's lecture, it was only about a block and a half or two from the college campus to the suicide bridge in Pasadena. And a young college student walked to that bridge and climbed up and dove off on his head about 80 feet to the pavement and killed himself. He hated himself. He couldn't stand to live with himself anymore after the professor got through with him. That professor, to me, has always been a person who epitomizes these verses. Job in a Hickey Freeman suit. God forbid that I should justify you till I die. I will not remove mine integrity from me. My righteousness is my most prized possession. More than my automobile, my home, my wife. It doesn't matter what kind of decisions I make that might cost a human being their life. I have my integrity. I have my righteousness. No, dear, you shouldn't have the operation. You should die. But I have my integrity. I have my righteousness. And I can stand at the funeral and look down and look very sad and wonder what everyone is thinking of me as they put my loved one's body in the grave. But my righteousness I hold fast, and I will never let it go. My heart shall not reproach me for as long as I live. Let mine enemy be as the wicked, and he that rises up against me as the unrighteous. For what is the hope of the hypocrite, though he is gained, when God take away his soul? Will God hear his cry when trouble comes upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call upon God? And then he goes on about the portion of the wicked, verse 13 and verse 14. If his children be multiplied, it's for no use. It's for the sword. Verse 15, those that remain of him shall be buried in death, and his widow shall not weep. Though he heap up silver as the dust and prepare raiment as the clay, he may prepare it, but the just shall put it on, and the innocent shall divide the silver. He builds his house as a moth, and as a booth that the keeper makes. The rich man shall lie down, but he shall not be gathered. He opens his eyes, and he is not. All that he gets, all that he accumulates, his wealth, it's all gone. An east wind carries him away, verse 21. And of course, Job is likening what happened to him and applying it to people who were evil. The difference being that Job has his integrity, and the wicked man has nothing. Job argued and argued and argued, and the other man argued and argued and argued. And finally, there was another party to all of this, whose name was Elihu. And Elihu would never open his mouth. He listened in amazement back and forth for hours to this long philosophical argument. Chapter 32 and verse 1. So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Isn't it interesting that in the book of Job, even Satan the devil could not spot the sin of self-righteousness? A person who is afflicted of it, who has self-righteousness, is blinded to the greatest sin, apparently, of all. Now, we've all heard the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, and we know what Jesus said about it. How the Pharisee and the publican went down to the temple to pray, and the Pharisee said, I thank thee that I am not as other men, that I fast twice in a week, I give tithes of all that I possess, and that's why we must not make comparisons, why we must not get locked into some rigmarole and make a religion out of routine, make a religion out of doing the things Mr. Dart was telling us we ought to do. But you don't make a religion out of that and begin to worship that routine, that X number of hours of prayer per week, or so many chapters of the Bible per week, or so many letters to sick friends, or dutifully go to the hospital, and then feel righteous about it. Like you're making little X's or little golden stars on the board in the sixth grade. You're just really adding to your righteousness. The concept that you are getting righteous by those deeds will actually erase those deeds. He was righteous in his own eyes. Verse 2. Then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, the kindred of Ram. And you can go back and look at where those people are mentioned back in the book of Genesis. Against Job was his wrath kindled because he justified himself rather than God. Also, against his three friends was his wrath kindled because they had found no answer, and yet they had condemned Job. Now, Elihu had waited till Job had spoken because they were elder than he. When Elihu saw there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, then his wrath was kindled. And Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, answered and said, and I don't know why, but I love these following verses. I am young, and you are very old. Wherefore I was afraid, and dared not show you my opinion. I said days should speak, and multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there is a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the Almighty gives them understanding. Great men are not always wise, neither do the aged understand judgment. Therefore I said, listen to me, and I will show you my opinion. Behold, I waited for your words, I gave ear to your reasons, while you searched out what to say. I attended unto you, and behold, it was none of you that convinced Job, or that answered his words, lest you should say, we have found out wisdom, God thrust him down, not man. Now he's directed his words against me, not directed his words against me, neither will I answer him with your speeches. And that shut the three up. They were amazed. They answered no more. They left off speaking. When I waited, for they spake not, but stood still and answered no more, I said, I will answer also my part, and I will show my opinion. For I am filled with words or the matter. The spirit within me constrains me. Behold, my belly is as wine which has no vent. It's ready to burst like new wineskins. I will speak that I may be refreshed. I will open my lips and answer. Let me not, I pray you, accept any man's person. Neither let me give flattering titles unto man, for I know not to give flattering titles. In so doing, my Maker would soon take me away. Now talk about preparatory words to set the stage for a younger man to speak to older men when he said, I'm not going to respect any man's person. It's flowing out of me, it's been pent up and bottled in there, and God is able to give me wisdom, though I am younger than you. Not trying to flatter anyone. Not trying to butter anyone up. No stroking, no backslapping intended at all. Wherefore, Job, I pray thee, hear my speeches and hearken to all my words. Behold, now I've opened my mouth, my tongue has spoken in my mouth. My words shall be of the uprightness of my heart, and my lips shall utter knowledge clearly. The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty has given me life. If you can answer me, set your words in order before me, stand up. What kind of an opening is this? All I am, he says, is a human being, planet Earth. The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty has given me life. My claim to equality is that I am your fellow human man. Behold, I am according to your wish in God's stead. I also am formed out of the clay. God is the Creator. Is the title of so many sermons in the Bible, it's amazing. Remember how in the sixth chapter of the book of Matthew, right in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus told us and told the disciples then about wealth, about the desire to accumulate material goods, about greed. He said, look at the lilies. He said, take a look at the grass of the field. He talked about the fowls of the air that fed themselves. And Solomon, he said, in all of his glory, was never arrayed like one of those beautiful flowers. Our Lord and Savior pointed to such mundane things as a beautiful flowering plant to remind us of who we are and who God is. And what did the Apostle Paul do to the Areopagites over in Acts 17, 18 through 31? His sermon was, him whom you ignorantly worship, the unknown God, him do I declare unto you. For God, he said, who made the worlds, needeth not anything, and dwells not in temples made with men's hands, and doesn't have anything that he needs, so that he's not worshipped with men's hands. He's made of all breath, and made all nations of one blood to dwell under the heavens and on this earth. And even as one of your own poets has said, in him we live and move and have our being. And what did Paul talk to those Gentiles about? But God as the Creator. Now let me get off my chest a personal gripe, just for a few moments. I love the subject of geology, biology, zoology. I love astronomy. I have some of my old textbooks, and once in a while I can even be found reading, of all things, a geology textbook, after all these years of being out of college. I love doing radio and television programs on the subject of stratigraphy and the onion skin theory and the geologic succession of strata, and zeroing in on little specific things such as the symbiotic relationship between a sea anemone and maybe the clownfish to prove that God exists. And sometimes I will get letters from people within the church who want me to go into certain portions of the Bible, like Colossians 3 or Ephesians 4 or 1 Corinthians 15, and just stay there and do nothing but talk about the Lord Jesus and His grace. And that must be talked about, must be preached, and must be understood. But you would be amazed if you were to look into what Peter said, not only on the day of Pentecost, but in his famous books, especially 2 Peter, the 3rd chapter. Seeing that all these things shall be on fire and melt with fervent heat, what manner of people ought we to be? Talking about the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished, and that the world that now is being kept in store unto a fiery destruction. Talking about the elements of the earth, talking about the creation of the earth, talking about the flood of Noah, talking about how with God, 1,000 years is like one day whizzing by to us. These men of God talked about God as the Creator. Look at Romans 1, verses 18 through 21 in the remainder of that chapter, where the Apostle Paul said that the things about the divinity of God, the unseen Godhead, are known even to the pagan Gentiles because God has just trotted it out and shown it to them. It's visible, it's evident. That you can prove God by studying about your own mind, about your own body, the process of birth. You know, when my boys were growing up, and I would try to teach them certain things, and because they were handicapped and couldn't hear my voice, I was able to teach them some things about nature. I would take a seed, for example, like a bean or a pea or whatever, that we were going to plant in the garden. I would take a knife, and I would just cut it open, and open it up, and we would look at it. And I would explain that there's a little pattern there, locked into that little seed. Whether it was a little tiny seed, like a little round seed for a radish or whatever. We would plant it in the ground. As the garden grew, I could explain to them that that little pattern was able to pull out of the soil through those little tiny tentacles that we call roots. All the elements and nutritious, we call them vitamins, meaning life-giving minerals that are in the soils, anything from iodine to iron to zinc, even the metals that make up a part of your body with which God has made His universe. And that those are put into a certain structure that is a living plant and can be ingested into your body and absorbed into your bloodstream and carried into the tissues of your body and your brain, and that you, therefore, are that dirt that magically is absorbed into the plant, and the plant is absorbed by your body, but all it's doing is giving you a marvelous chemical method that God Himself created to eat dirt, because dirt you are, and unto dirt shall you return. We're of the dust, we're of the earth. Great oaks from little acorns grow, sure, but how do they? You ever look at an acorn? You ever eat one? You ever take one with a knife and cut it in two and look at it and try to see the trunks and the branches and the leaves? 400 years of a huge gnarled oak tree under whose shade families could dwell, all from that little kernel that has no real form other than just a semi oval or round shape, but there's, if you look at the nut inside of an acorn, there are no interesting little curlicues anywhere. It just looks like a garbanzo or something. But when you look into it, it's absolutely fascinating. Nature, fish, birds, weather, the wind, snow, clouds, rain, the seas, huge continents, mountain ranges, minerals, clay, foodstuffs, wild animals like chamois or goats, a hawk, an eagle in the air. Guess who uses those things to humble man? God does. And there is more said about those things by God than even any man in the Bible, as we will see. Now, of course, Elihu was saying, I'm just a human being, planet Earth. I'm formed out of the clay. Verse 7, behold, my terror will not make you afraid. Who am I? I'm nobody. Neither shall my hand be heavy upon you. I have no power to hurt you. Surely you've spoken in my hearing. I've heard your voice of your word saying, I am clean without transgression. I am innocent. Neither is there iniquity in me. Behold, he, God, finds occasions against me. He counts me for his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks. He marks all my paths. Behold, in this, you are not just. You get what Elihu perceived Job was doing? Job was saying, now God does this to me, and I do that. Me and God. God and me. I and God. God and I. God does this, and I do that. He does this, and I'm this way. Me and God. Me and Jesus got it all worked out. I've got this special relationship with God that's different from you other guys, you see. A greater measure of understanding. Why, God and I, he and I, God and I, just me and God. That's the way Job talked all the way through the book of Job. And now when Elihu says that, he says, behold, in this you are not just, verse 12, I will answer you that God is greater than man. Why do you strive against him? For he gives not account of any of his matters. Now, you know, this is the stuff of Romans, the 11th chapter. No, but who are you, O man, that reply to God? Now, think about this, because some of you have thought this way, and others will, no doubt. I've had people come up to me. Matters of understanding doctrinally. Now, is it true that God says you must keep the Sabbath, God says you must keep the holy days, God says this and that, and so on. So three things they'll set you up for it. Yes. Well, then, if that is true, then how come God says, do this? You know, I weary of questions like that, if you follow what I'm saying. We want to get God all locked up into a system that we can really fathom and understand. What appeals to us as fair? Does it really matter to God, is what Elihu was saying? Is it fair that God, on the one hand, struck Uzzah dead for doing nothing more than reaching up and trying to steady the ark? Was it really fair? I got a letter from a woman that said it wasn't, and she could never worship the God who would cause bears to rip up teenagers who came out and disparaged the prophet of God. Go on, you old bald-headed fool, they said to Elisha. And all of a sudden, roar! A bunch of bears tore them up, killed them. I got a letter from a little old lady that says, I won't worship your God of the Old Testament. Any God that would rip up those children, says children in the Bible, and she didn't know it meant teenagers. I guess same thing. She said, I could never worship a God like that. There are people that decide they've got God locked in a box. They read about God. They understand God. And finally they decide, now I know how God ought to act. And since God is consistent, and he never changes, anytime there was some inconsistency, even like David eating the showbread, that kind of jangles their sense of the way they've got God locked in the box, and suddenly God is not progressing from A through Z, and he stuck something weird in there, did something crazy they didn't expect of him, and it just boggles their mind. They'll come up to you, trot out a scripture, and say, now how come it says this here in the Bible? And it makes me want to jump back and watch for this big hole to open up and just a singed area around the edge of it, and this person that said that's gone. What happened to him? Oh, he was questioning God. Now, not really, but you know, sometimes you wonder about that. I had been away from cursing and taking God's name in vain for many years, and I had done that in the Navy, just like many of you have done that, and used God's name in vain and in cursing. And one time, my wife and I were on the way to the Feast of Tabernacles, and I got a flat tire. We were over in Arizona somewhere, and we pulled into a service station, and the fellow was changing the tire, and I don't know, he barked his thumb or his index finger, got it between the iron that he was using and the rim, I guess. And I mean, he just jumped back and took God's name in vain, and then I jumped back expecting to watch him disappear. And my wife, we talked about that because that was the first time in maybe a year and a half or two or three or whatever that I had even heard anyone, because I'd been so sheltered now from the time since I'd been baptized in the church that I had never heard. I've been in college classes and preaching and teaching and Bible studies and around the students and so on, and going to the Feast of Tabernacles, of course, and that was the highlight of the spiritual year. And here's this guy cursing the air blue, and I expected God to just say, that ant, and just kill him right there on the spot. But he didn't, and I just kind of stayed away from the guy because I didn't want to get struck by the same bolt of lightning that was going to kill him. But do you know what I'm getting at? There are a lot of times where we think we have God all figured out. And then God will allow something or do something that isn't the way we've got Him figured out. And we get a little irked at Him. Now, why did God do it that way? And Elihu has put his finger on the problem. And he simply says, Job, I got news for you. God is greater than man. Why do you strive against Him? He doesn't have to account to you for any of His matters. God speaks one, yea, twice, yet man perceives it not. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls upon men and slumberings upon the bed, then He opens the ears of men and seals their instruction, that He may withdraw man from his purpose and hide pride from man. He keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword. He is chastened also with pain upon his bed and the multitude of his bones with strong pain, so that his life abhors bread and his soul dainty meat. His flesh is consumed away that it cannot be seen, and his bones that were not seen stick out, describing Job's condition pretty well. Yea, his soul draws near unto the grave and his life to the destroyers. If there be an angel or a messenger with him, an interpreter, one among a thousand, to show on a man his uprightness, then he is gracious unto him and says, deliver him from going down to the pit, I have found a ransom. His flesh shall be fresher than a child's, he will return to the days of his youth. He shall pray unto God, and he will be favorable unto him. And he will see his face with joy, for he will render unto man his righteousness. He looks upon men, and if any say, I have sinned, and perverted that which was right, and it profits me not, or as the margin says, or it should read here, it was not requited unto me, he will deliver his soul from going into Sheol or the pit, and his life shall see the light. Lo, all these things works God oftentimes with man, to bring back his life from Sheol, to be enlightened with the light of the living. Mark well, O Job, hearken unto me. Now listen, and I'll speak. If you have anything to say, answer me. Speak, I desire to justify you. If not, just listen to me. Hold your peace, and I'm going to teach you some wisdom. Now let's look at the wisdom that Elihu taught him. Chapter 34 was the truth. Chapter 35 is the truth. Chapter 36 is the truth. All Elihu speaking in chapter 37 is Elihu speaking to Job. Let's look at a few of the things he said. Verse 5. Job has said, Elihu speaking, I am righteous, and God has taken away my judgment. Should I lie against my right, my wound is incurable without transgression. What man is Job who drinks up scorning like water? Who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men, for he has said it profits a man nothing that he should delight himself with God. Therefore hearken unto me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should commit iniquity. Verse 12. Yea, surely God will not do wickedly, neither will the Almighty pervert judgment. The upshot of what Job was arguing was that God actually has done wrong. Job had done no wrong. God was the one in the wrong. I remember a lady years ago who became demon-possessed out of the loss of a child. She became such a mental case that she actually was institutionalized later. She just couldn't understand it. She was in the church. She was hearing the sermons, going to the feast, studying the Bible. The wife of a very fine young man lost a very young child, I don't know if it was crib death or what, and just kept on agonizing over that baby and blaming God. Why did God let it happen? Got mad at God, got upset with God, and after a certain number of months became, I believe, possessed of a spirit being, because there were others who were there and who actually, from time to time, it seemed, upon casting the demon out, she would return to normal, would be her own self, then suddenly revert, and a completely different personality would take over, and finally, the marriage was destroyed, the woman was institutionalized, because she didn't know the Scripture. That oftentimes on this great big world, humming away as it turns slowly out here in the blackness of the universe, the little things of our lives that are so important to us are not necessarily things that touch God. Our righteousness does not move God to tears. Our sin does not deter Him from a moment's joy, necessarily. The upshot of what Elihu was saying is, our activities do not change God from His purpose, do not alter His character, do not change His judgments, do not make Him less righteous or more righteous, that we on this earth are just a little spark of life with a glorious opportunity that most of us never really capture or realize with our mind just what that opportunity is. We're red clay mud. We're only prototypes. We're only models running around for a little while. We have a short span of life that can be taken from us so quickly. When I think of what happened to the young Kilchesky man, I mean powerfully built, strong, sinewy, able to send a canoe through the water with great speed. Very fine young man, really very skilled in all of the use of a lot of equipment and outdoors and so on, knowing how to camp and to track and to be out there in the wilderness, and really a very strong and a very healthy young man. And in just moments, a little tiny microscopic virus begins to explode into millions of other viruses, and those powerful muscles now are just like so much pudding. He weighs barely more than 120 pounds, lying in a hospital paralyzed except for his voice, and the muscles wither away. Why? Well, because man and his medicines has figured out a way to vaccinate against a very horrible killer and crippler of children, polio. And once every so many millions of times, an unvaccinated parent will actually get the virus from the vaccinated child whose body is actually, of course, being host to the same viruses to form antibodies to protect him against infectious polio. The child will be fine, but the parent, unless God heals him, is only going one direction. It will take a miracle from God because there is absolutely nothing medical science can do. And where was God? And why did it happen? And why did He allow it? Is there a person in this room who can tell me? I confess to you, I can't tell you. I don't know. I haven't the faintest idea. No, God will not do wickedly. God does not pervert judgment. Verse 14, if He set His heart upon man, if He gather unto Himself His spirit and His breath, all flesh will perish together. And it's very confusing. What it is saying to us is this. If God were to withdraw His spirit from this earth, all life would die. It means God is the sustainer. The Apostle Paul had said, even quoting a pagan philosopher, in Him we live and move and have our being, is saying that if God were to withdraw His spirit, all man, all animals, and all plant life would just wither up and return to dust and die. There would be no living earth here below. If you have understanding, listen to this. Hearken to the voice of my words. Shall even he that hateth right govern? And will you condemn him that is most just? Verse 18 of chapter 34. Is it fit to say to a king, you are wicked, and to princes, you are ungodly? How much less to him it accepts not the persons of princes, nor regards the rich more than the poor? This was very important to me, this concept, in coming to understand the truth about divorce and remarriage. Coming to understand whether or not the petty machinations of human beings with their papier-mâché, man-made physical societies touch God. Whether He's concerned about it. When the young princess with the funny many-turreted hat with the long painted nails about that long walks into a Buddhist temple in Vietnam to marry a prince with tattoos all over his body, God's looking down, is He? And all the angels are in attendance, are they? And when the bong strikes and they turn around several times and make all the funny signs with their hands, the key turns and you hear it clanking eternally down through the corridors of time, and that young man and that young girl in Vietnam will someday be resurrected and will live together as husband and wife for all eternity. Is that right? Is God in the marriage business? Is God in the contractual business? Every time people strike hands, every time somebody signs a document, God says, I'm going to bind that. I'm going to stand behind that. I'm locking that up in heaven. No way. No way. But a profound understanding finally came over me. You know what it was? My life is not a bit more important than one of those Vietnamese boat people in the sight of God. I am no more important than a black ghetto child. And neither are you. Your life is no more special. You are no more specially a favorite of His. He doesn't love you any more than He loves those people in China. China, what's that? A big yellow blob on a map. About every fifth or almost every fourth human being on the face of the earth are Chinese. And yet we sort of write them off, well, you know, Christ will take care of them later on, after he comes, the work that is going to reach all of these Gentile nations. We must reach Israel, so let's just forget them, write them off. And we tend to just disparage them as human beings. No, we have to understand that Almighty God is not, as the Bible says, a respecter of persons. If I've been given a calling, if you have been given a calling, let's just praise God's name for that and give him thanks. But we are not special, and we are no better because of that calling than a Vietnamese, a Chinese, or a black in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Look how Elihu spoke to Job in trying to humble him. In chapter 35, in verse 3, you said, "What advantage will it be unto you? And what profit shall I have if I be cleansed from my sin? And I'll answer you and your friends there with you." Now, look unto the heavens and see, and behold the clouds which are higher than you are. If you sin, what do you against him? Or if your transgressions be multiplied, how do you really affect God? What do you do unto him? If you be righteous, what are you handing him? You made him richer? What reward have you given God? Or what does he receive of your hand? Now, your wickedness may hurt a man like you are. Take up a gun and kill somebody, that's a sin. That hurts somebody. Hurt you, hurt families. Does it really hurt God? And your righteousness may profit the Son of Man. You're honest, you're fair, you succeed, others are blessed. Fine. By reason of the multitude of oppressions, they make the oppressor to cry. They cry out by reason of the arm of the mighty. But none says, "Where is God my Maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth, and makes us wiser than the fowls of heaven?" There they cry, but none gives answer, because of the pride of evil men. Surely God will not hear vanity, neither will the Almighty regard it. Although you say you shall not see him, yet judgment is before him. Therefore, you trust in him. Therefore, in verse 16, Job opens his mouth in vain. He multiplies words without knowledge. And Elihu continues on. Chapter 36, you can read that later. I'm going to skip along to verse 29 of that chapter. Also, can any understanding the spreadings of the clouds, or the noise of his tabernacle? Behold, he spreads his light upon it and covers the bottom of the sea. For by them judges he the people. He gives meat in abundance. With clouds he covers or obscures the light, and commands it not to shine by the clouds that come between. The noise thereof shows concerning it, the cattle also concerning the vapor, rather poorly translated, and the Living Bible and some of the new translations make it clearer. But notice how he begins speaking about the elements, about weather, about the seasons, about creatures, about the seas. Chapter 37. Verse 3, his voice, the sound of his mouth, he directs it unto the whole heaven, and his lightning to the ends of the earth. After the voice roars, he thunders at the voice of his excellency. He will not stay them when his voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with his voice. Great things does he, which we cannot comprehend. He says to the snow, "Be thou on the earth," and likewise to the small rain, meaning a sprinkling, a very gentle rain, and to the great rain, summer thunder shower, of his strength. And when you're standing out of doors and lightning strikes about a block away, it does kind of make you think of God a little bit, doesn't it? You ever notice how that happens? A converted, a Christian person, a person that knows the Bible, doesn't just look at that as some, you know, passing little phenomenon of nature. Thoughts of God kind of enter their minds. I remember one time old Lyle Christopherson was actually recording his thoughts during a summer thunderstorm up in Big Sandy. He was staying in the executive house up there. He had his little tape recorder, and he was out on the porch. And lightning struck the TV antenna and came inside and blew up the little thing that was hooked up to the wires that they switched the antenna with. Just blew it into bits. And he could just hear this kind of a zap in the recorder. And that was into his recording. He jumped straight up in the air and turned around and went into that house so fast, got off of that porch. And it was one of those real toad stranglers. I mean, a rain coming down in sheets and lightning every couple of seconds, and it was just awesome. Now, I've been in those, both up in the air and aircraft, as well as down on the earth, and I'll guarantee you, it makes you think about God. One time going into Eugene, Oregon, they've got about a 7-step-down VORDME approach instead of an ILS, because you're going over mountains, and every so many miles closer to the station, you go down a few more hundred feet. And we were in thick snow in the Falcon, couldn't see a thing, at night, except every now and then everything lit up. Just like being in the middle of a flashlight. And when it wasn't lighting up outside, it was lighting up inside because playing, believe me, just like tentacles, like this, all over the windshield, was St. Elmo's fire. Bright green, moving very slowly, and all of the most beautiful little etched, like miniature lightning, just playing over the cockpit. From friction, and from the fact that however the ions of electricity are arranged, that apparently we were being charged with negative particles, and were inviting a lightning strike. Do you think for a minute I didn't pray, flying that airplane on that approach, with St. Elmo's fire keeping me entertained on the windshield? Stood my hair on end. Unbelievable. Out of the north, or the south rather, verse 8, comes the whirlwind and the cold out of the north. By the breath of God, frost is given. Well, I could go on and on, but I want to bring it to a close. To come through this, you can read the remainder of that, and you're looking at light and clouds and seasons. Verse 21, the wind passes and cleanses. Fair weather comes out of the north. Does it or doesn't it? You bet it does. He knew that, and it's true today. Chapter 38, then the Eternal, who of course heard all of this, answered Job out of the whirlwind, and said, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins now like a man, and I will demand of you, and you answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if you have understanding. Now God is talking, not Elihu. And God picks up on the theme that Elihu introduced. He says in verse 7, where were you when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Giving you a picture of what the angels did when God said, behold, it is finished, and it was a beautiful earth here. Far more beautiful than the one we live upon today. Or who shut up the sea with doors when it broke forth, as if it had issued out of the womb? When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it. Verse 16, have you entered into the springs of the sea? And of course man knows that there are deep springs and subterranean water tables miles under the earth with actual flowing rivers here and there that they call aquifers, but they only know the little bit that they can understand by barely scratching the surface of our big earth. Have you walked in this search of the depths? Have the gates of death been opened to you? Have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Have you perceived the breadth of the earth? Declare if you know it all. Where is the way where light dwells? Where's light come from? As for darkness, where is the place thereof? That you should take it to the bound thereof, that you should know the paths to the house thereof. Do you know it because you were then born? Or because the number of your days is great? Don't ask me why I like that part. I just do. Verse 22. Have you entered into the treasures of the snow? I have, but not in the way that God means. When you're in an area where you're able to ski and you're going up in a ski lift in a real heavy snowstorm and you're up there and just white everywhere and beautiful snow weighing the trees down like the proverbial winter wonderland, you'll hold your mittens or your gloves open and let the snowflakes just pepper you, you know, and hit and bounce off and watch them before they melt. And every one of them is absolutely incredibly beautiful. You couldn't design, you couldn't draw anything like that, and every one of them is different. And that's the amazing thing. They say that out of the countless trillions or quadrillion billions, jillions or whatever of snowflakes there are in just one winter snowstorm, no two of them are alike. And yet every one of them is symmetrical and beautiful. God says, have you entered into the treasures of the snow? Have you seen the treasures of the hail which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle and war? Verse 25, who has divided a watercourse for the overflowing of waters, or a way for the lightning of thunder to cause it to rain on the earth where no rain is, on the wilderness wherein there is no man, to satisfy the desolate and waste ground and to cause the bud of the tender herb to spring forth? These remaining chapters, 39, 40, chapter 40, verse 15, look now at Behemoth, which I made with you, eats grass like an ox. His strength is in his loins, the force in the navel of his belly. He moves his tail like a cedar. That's some kind of a great being, maybe proof in the Bible that man lived in the time of dinosaurs. And right here in Texas, somewhere down near a place called Cedar Springs, I think it is, there are actual footprints of men and dinosaurs in the same clay. That's not the name of the town. It doesn't come to me. There's a city somewhere in Texas where that could actually be.
Glenroe.
Where is that? Down near the hill country? San Antonio area? If it's not too far, someday I want to see that with my own eyes. I've seen pictures of it. It'd be fascinating to go there. Actual footprint of a man and footprint of dinosaurs in the same clay, same strata, hardened in a rock, incontrovertible evidence. And this to me is right in the Bible. Look at the language of the latter part of chapter 41. And the fascinating thing to me is, brethren, God is talking, not a man. He talks about Leviathan, chapter 41. And verse, let's look at the description and see what we're talking about here, beginning in verse 12 of chapter 41. I will not conceal his parts, nor his power, nor his comely proportion. Who can discover the face of his garment, or who can come to him with his double bridle? This is a beast so big that could not be contained. Who can open the doors of his face? His teeth are terrible round about. His scales are his pride, shut up together with close seal, just like the armor on an alligator's hide. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They're joined one to another, that's the scales, they cannot be sundered. Notice verse 20, out of his nostrils goes smoke as of a seething pot or cauldron, meaning perhaps a beast that dwelled in the seas and came up like a huge blue whale, and with a huge roaring sound exudes a tremendous gust of hot air from the lungs of an air-breathing mammal that turn instantly to steam, and that can be heard for miles away. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. In his neck remains strength, and sorrow is turned into joy before him. The flakes of his flesh are joined together. They are firm. They cannot be moved. When he raises himself up, verse 25, the mighty are afraid. Verse 26, the sword of him that lays at him cannot hold, the spear, the dart, nor the habergeon. He esteems iron as straw, and brass as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned with him into stubble. Darts are counted as stubble. He laughs at the shaking of a spear. Verse 31, he makes the deep to boil like a pot. That sounds like a huge sea creature, almost like a sea monster or something, that is so gigantic that when he would suddenly move, it just makes the sea boil. Makes the sea boil like a pot of ointment. He makes a path to shine after him, leaving a huge phosphorescent wake. One would think the deep to be hoary, meaning frothy or white. Upon earth there is not his like, who is made without fear. He beholds all high things. He is the king over the children of pride. I find it fascinating that that is the last statement from God to Job, followed by Job's repentance. That God made Job forcibly look at the greatness of God by looking at the things God has made. At the earth, at seasons, at rain and snow, summer thunder showers, huge living creatures, birds, we didn't read it all. He talks about the way of an eagle in the air, talks about look at the ants, look at the conies in the rocks, of their incredible knowledge. For example, right now the robins are migrating through here in East Texas, and you can always know in various parts of the country the farmers that will watch the squirrels out a little earlier than usual, and some of the pocket gophers and others out earlier than usual gathering seeds and rushing back and forth like they're really just crazy to fill those dens with all the seeds they can. And they say, uh-oh, we're going to have a real tough winter, and it's coming early. Sure enough, they do. But the animals and creatures knew it before they did. And Job then finally says, I know that you can do everything and that no thought can be withheld from you. Who is he that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered things that I understood not, things too wonderful for me, which I didn't know. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear. Heard about God, about Christ, about the Bible, about salvation and regeneration, redemption, baptism, receiving the Holy Spirit. But he didn't really see God in the greatness of God in the way that he should. So he said, now mine eye sees thee. But what had he really seen? He'd seen with the mind's eye the greatness of God as creator. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. And it was so that God said this, my wrath is kindled against thee, he said, to Eliphaz the Temanite, and against your two friends, Bildad and Zophar. For you have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job has. He omits mention of Elihu. Therefore, you go and you take these bullocks and make a burnt offering, and maybe my servant Job will pray for you. For him I will accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, in that you have spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job. So they did, and the Eternal accepted Job, and you can read the rest of it of how he is blessed far more than he ever had been before. The names of his children are given, thousands of camels and sheep and so on. And after this, verse 16, Job lived 140 years and saw his sons and his sons' sons even four generations. So Job died being old and full of days and being not self-righteous, but a converted man, as much so as one could with the Holy Spirit of God working with him instead of having a begettal of Jesus Christ as we are offered today. I find it fascinating that the whole highlight to me of the statement was Elihu when he told Job, God is greater than man. Let's never forget that. It's very easy to think me and Jesus got a good thing going. You have your own personal little way of working things out with God. When you do something bad, God is disappointed. When you do something good, God is pleased. Really? Have you ever aspired? Have you ever achieved? Have you ever progressed so far that your life, what you do, what you think, what you say, your desires, your loved ones, the way you feel, whether you're in pain or whether you feel good, really reaches that great Creator out there, that He notices you? I hope so. If so, that's great. But let's learn the lesson from Job, that every good deed we do may have something to do with others around us and may have something to do to accruing to character, but every one of those good deeds can be undone instantly, tomorrow or next week, by things that we do to ourselves. But it won't make any difference to God in the long run, because God is greater than man. Don't be self-righteous. Realize God says our righteousnesses are as filthy rags before Him, and realize the only true righteousness you can have is in Jesus Christ, who is flawless and is perfect. And then you'll have it straight. If your righteousness is only the righteousness He imputes to you, that He applies to you because He is perfect, and everything you do is in Him and through Him, and to Him goes the credit, and to Him goes the honor, and to Him goes all of the great glory, and you always say, Christ is great because He has done this and that, not I am great, look what I did. Then you'll have it straight, because it is only to the glory of Jesus Christ when we do that which is right.